Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. We would like to wish a warm welcome to our new listeners on KPFA in Berkeley. If you know anyone who listens to KPFA, please let them know that they can hear the Media Roundtable on Fridays at 3 p.m. And if you're a new listener on our Media Roundtable every week, we invite journalists to discuss coverage of the week's news and undercovered stories. We're kicking off today's show by talking about how Brett Kavanaugh would change environmental law from the Supreme Court. We are also talking about the state of the Environmental Protection Agency under Andrew Wheeler after Scott Pruitt was forced to resign. And tomorrow, people in cities around the world are taking to the streets to call on local leaders to commit to transitioning to 100% renewable energy. The actions in San Francisco will coincide with the Global Climate Action Summit. Joining us to discuss coverage is Rebecca Lieber. Rebecca writes about environmental and climate policy for Mother Jones. She's a former staff writer at The New Republic and editor at Grist. In 2017, Rebecca Lieber was given a SEAL Award as one of the 10 best environmental journalists in the United States. And Rebecca joins us in studio. Hi, Rebecca. Thank you for coming in.
Thanks so much for having me here.
Great to have you. Well, as we always do on Your Calls Media Roundtable, we start off on a positive note and highlight journalism that stood out. So what caught your attention this week?
Well, Quartz and Texas Tribune published this really ambitious look at water policy in this era of emerging mega droughts and climate change. And it was a really powerful series of, I believe, 9 stories where they looked at everything from border issues and water supplies and how future mega droughts will affect water access. And it's a hugely complicated issue. It's personally one of the areas that terrifies me most about climate change is how we handle dwindling water supplies. So it was a really powerful investigative series, and I recommend readers tune into that.
Can you elaborate on what you just said? What really concerns you the most, dwindling water supplies?
Well, there's a lot of things to be frightened about for climate change. Mm-hmm. I think the two issues that I worry about in terms of stability and future civilization, one is our oceans and how drastically we're changing them. We are causing major dead zones in freshwater and oceans due to lots of complicating factors, but also because of climate change and warmer atmosphere, fresh water is a very small portion of our water on Earth, and it is at risk in areas that are already vulnerable and areas that have seen conflict in the past. It's a huge pressure point. And when you hear the military talk about climate change as a threat multiplier, this is one of the areas that it really strains conflict.
Well, this is a huge issue. And to add to the kudos that you gave to Quartz, The Wall Street Journal had a piece this week called Schools Across the United States Find Elevated Lead Levels in Drinking Water. As kids are going back to school, they are finding lead in their water. I mean, Detroit, you know, they're dealing with so much. Flint is still drinking bottled water, and Detroit had to shut off water fountains at 106 public schools.
Yeah, that's a hugely underrated story. I feel like people kind of think of Flint as this isolated situation when it really is affecting kids across the country. And I just yesterday was talking to the former environmental justice staffer at EPA, Mustafa Ali, and he was making a great point that there are 3,000 communities where lead is higher than in Flint. And yet this is not something we talk about as a national crisis, even though it really is.
Well, thank you for that. I've been wanting to check out the Quartz piece. I've seen a few of the reporters interviewed. Really incredible work looking at water issues along the border, and we will put links to those stories at yourcallradio.org. I also wanted to add one. The New York Times has some leaked documents about Judge Kavanaugh and what he has said about abortion and affirmative action, and I just want to read the lead from Charlie Savage. Judge Brett Kavanaugh challenged the accuracy of deeming the Supreme Court's landmark Roe v. Wade abortion rights decision to be, quote, settled law of the land, according to a secret email obtained by the New York Times. The email was written in March 2003, one of thousands of documents that Kavanaugh, as he was a lawyer for Bush, or that a lawyer for Bush turned over to the Senate Judiciary Committee about Kavanaugh, but deemed committee confidential. I want to ask you, Rebecca, about coverage. Roe v. Wade has gotten a lot of coverage this week, as it should. But what has really struck me is how reporters and pundits have so casually talked about the possibility of abortion becoming illegal in many states across this country. I mean, it's shocking to hear this in 2018, but these are the realities that we're facing. I mean, Jeffrey Toobin, a legal analyst on CNN, says that within 18 months, abortion could be illegal in 25 states in this country.
Yeah, that's incredible. I think in the Trump administration, we have these shifting realities and shifting dialogue, and it makes us feel it makes situations like imagining abortion being illegal feel because it could happen, people, I think, are more prone to accept that. And you hear all the time the people warning about normalizing certain policies and behaviors. And I think when we're talking about abortion, that's probably happening.
Vox has a great piece called If Kavanaugh is Concerned, Confirmed, Any of These 13 Cases Could End Roe v. Wade. The landmark abortion decision could be overturned within a year. NPR had a piece this week about how clinics in Massachusetts are preparing to welcome women who have to fly in from states where abortion is illegal. It's shocking to hear this. How do you think reporters should cover this moving forward? Because we are talking about lives at stake. It's going to hit poor women and people of color the worst. But so many people are going to be affected by this. If you don't have the money to fly, if you're a young girl living in a home where you can't talk about these issues, you're going to need at least 3 days. So do you think the media should cover this going forward?
Political journalists, especially it tends to be very male, are less affected by these kinds of decisions. I think turn this into a game of his confirmation, where it's dramatic and there's powerful moments of senators making speeches. But really, at the end of the day, the story is about the people affected, just like you said. And I think journalists, our role here is to bring those stories to light, and I think make this is an issue about people and their stories. We're not talking about numbers. And I think when you're talking about national politics, it's easy to just cite statistics, but telling the stories of the young girls, women affected, especially poor and people of color, and bringing those individual stories to light is the most powerful tool. And I don't think that just applies to abortion. This applies to environmental stories. This is across the board really what a journalist's job is.
Well, we will continue following this and talk about the real life consequences, which we're already seeing in places like Texas. Even in rural California, it's hard to get access, even where it's supposedly a safe state. Let's move on. As you said, journalists should also talk about how environmental policy affects actual people. And you wrote a piece for Mother Jones called Environmentalists Are Worried Trump's Supreme Court Pick is, quote, the next Scott Pruitt. Tell us about who you spoke with. And it's amazing to think that we're not even talking about Scott Pruitt anymore. It's like, where is he now? I mean, he did so much at the EPA, and then he was forced to resign, and we don't even talk about him anymore.
Yeah, he's been laying pretty low. I have not really seen or heard much about what he's up to. But when Kavanaugh was nominated, a lot of environmental groups and Democratic senators kind of sounded an alarm about his environmental record. And that was where that quote came from in the story, that senators who speak out regularly on this issue and climate change were worried that Kavanaugh would be Pruitt, not because of the personal ethics scandals that and Pruitt's troubles with getting a Chick-fil-A franchise for his wife, but because because Kavanaugh has demonstrated through a series of decisions on the circuit court a disdain for EPA authority, for the environmental law. And the way he does that is in this complicated, wonky issue that we can get into more on Chevron deference, and this affects more than just environment. But Kavanaugh is basically that fifth pivotal vote on the Supreme Court to throw out not just Obama-era regulations, but potentially uphold a lot of what Trump is doing when he is trying to replace these rules with something so weak it practically does nothing for power plants and for clean water and air. And the important thing to remember is Justice Kennedy was often the fifth vote for environmental cases that were decided in favor of the EPA in some cases, or on environmentalists' side when they were challenging the EPA to do more. And Kennedy was often that really pivotal fifth vote. Kavanaugh would swing the court in the other direction, and that's why this is an area he has the biggest stakes for. Unfortunately, I have not noticed this issue really come up so much in his hearings. It's gotten pretty little attention compared to all the other important policy, but it's a big one.
As you said, with the key vote by retiring Anthony Kennedy, the justices ruled that the Clean Air Act gave the EPA the power to regulate greenhouse gas emissions. Just on that issue alone, what could change?
Well, so Kennedy decided was a fifth vote on this pivotal decision called Massachusetts versus EPA that basically told the EPA, you have an obligation to regulate greenhouse gas emissions if the science supports that it's a danger to public health. And that's called an endangerment finding, and it's really the crux of every climate regulation you saw come out of the EPA since then. So when the Obama administration was putting forward its climate rules, this kind of got lost in the talking points on the right. But his EPA was actually forced to do that. They issued an endangerment finding saying that climate change is a danger to public health as the science supports. They had thousands of pages of documents to support this. And then going forward, they issued regulations changing or putting limits on emissions from cars and emissions from power plants, as the Clean Power Plan is called. And Kavanaugh has expressed skepticism of the EPA having this authority to regulate climate emissions. And he's not a climate denier. He's been very frank saying that he thinks climate change is a problem. And he said that in opinions in the past. The problem is he doesn't believe the EPA has the tools to do this. That is not what precedent on the Supreme Court has said. And that's why his seat on the bench could pose such a danger to that decision.
You report that Earth Justice has taken Trump and ex-EPA head Scott Pruitt to court on more than 100 decisions, and Kavanaugh could be the key to making sure their policies stay put. What are you hearing from environmental groups like Earth Justice, the Center for Biological Diversity, the groups that consistently take Trump, for example, and Scott Pruitt to court? How are they going to respond if Kavanaugh is confirmed?
Well, they're certainly worried. I spoke to one attorney at Earth Justice. I've spoken in the past to people at NRDC, and they actually warn about a few things. It's not just that Kavanaugh has this kind of disdain for EPA's authority to regulate on climate emissions. He also doesn't agree with the precedent called Chevron deference, which basically gives agencies the authority to interpret the law, and that is a powerful tool when you're talking about vague laws that they're handed and they have to use expertise to interpret them. Kavanaugh would represent a shift to the EPA and other agencies all these decisions having to be litigated in courtrooms. The third thing that he represents and worries environmental groups is he could block environmentalist access to courtrooms. This came up with the last Supreme Court confirmation that Kavanaugh would and conservative justices increasingly have questioned the standing of environmental groups and public advocacy groups, that they could bring citizen suits and suits to enforce the law, which is really important when you're talking about how you bring court cases through the court system and force the government to actually act on laws that Congress passed. Kavanaugh could say, be more skeptical, essentially, that environmentalists don't have access to the courtroom and that bar them from some of these cases. That's an issue that I think gets pretty much no attention, but comes up all the time in my interviews with top attorneys like At Earth Justice who are bringing these cases.
Today, we are speaking with Rebecca Lieber. She writes about environmental and climate policy for Mother Jones. In 2017, Rebecca was given a SEAL Award as one of the 10 best environmental journalists in the United States. And she is here in San Francisco to cover the Global Climate Action Summit. A number of world leaders will be in town over the week to talk about climate change and the environment, and we are expecting massive demonstrations on the streets. Tomorrow, people in cities around the world are taking to the streets to call on local leaders to commit to transitioning to 100% renewable energy. And here in San Francisco, indigenous activists will be at the front of the march, as always, playing a crucial role in these marches. And today it's our Your Call Media Roundtable. I want to talk to you about pollution because this is very, very important. The Environmental Working Group put out a statement and quoted Earth Justice, finding that of 18 EPA-related cases decided on substantive rather than procedural grounds, Judge Kavanaugh ruled in favor of more pollution in 16 cases. He ruled that the EPA lacks the authority to regulate greenhouse gases and ruled against regulating cross-state air pollution, which is so important with all of these fires that we're having. He ruled that the EPA did not have to update carbon monoxide standards and sought to delay rules to limit emissions from the production of cancer-causing PVC. He ruled in favor of dumping coal waste and hazardous waste without regard to public health. And then he ruled that it's okay for factory farms to foul the air of their neighbors. Again, incredibly important. And this is a huge environmental justice issue because the people who live near factory farms tend to be poor and people of color. So these are very significant rulings.
Certainly. And the Supreme Court is a precedent-setting court that would affect rulings across the country, where we talk about these landmark cases, but then it trickles down into circuit courts, appeals, where most of these regulatory battles are happening. And courts, when it comes to Trump, have been absolutely pivotal to kind of being a check on the administration just wanting to throw out, like, completely blind throwing out regulations, replacing them in some cases with very weak regulations. And EPA under Trump has lost a lot of cases in the last few weeks alone. I think it was about five decisions that were made under Scott Pruitt were reversed by courts. And that they play such a pivotal role here in forcing agencies to actually adhere to the science. And what the Supreme Court could do, a five-justice majority of conservatives, would set precedent in the other direction.
Yeah, I'm glad you made that statement, because while the Supreme Court is getting so much attention right now, as it should, the Washington Post had a piece recently called How Trump is Shifting the Most Important Courts in the Country. The share of federal judges appointed by Republican and Democratic presidents since Reagan, they have this amazing graph, and it's changing quickly. Here's the lead. As his second appointment to the Supreme Court begins Senate hearings, dozens of Trump's picks for lower four federal courts have already been installed, leaving a conservative imprint on the nation's judiciary. In particular, the White House has filled the influential circuit court judgeships, the second highest courts in the United States, and the last stop for many major cases at a faster pace than his recent predecessors. More Trump picks to the circuit courts have been confirmed, 26 so far, than any recent president at this point in their term. I mean, this is massive because, as you said, these other courts are incredibly important, ruling on so many cases, and they're turning conservative, in many cases, extreme conservative.
Yeah, and I think, so when you look at what groups like the Federalist Society, which has a lot of sway in the Trump administration, mm-hmm. what they want, it's blocking environmentalists from the courtroom. It's throwing out Chevron deference and saying courts should litigate everything when it comes to things like, I mean, at the end of the day, you could say like courts could be deciding whether climate change is real or not. In some cases, it becomes ridiculous when you think about these justices who are experts in the law pouring through scientific documents and trying to understand the minutiae. That's why that expertise lies with agencies. It's really a huge burden and impossible for justices and their clerks to fully wrap their heads around every piece of the science.
And it's important to point out that these judicial nominations are for life. So if you appoint someone who's in their 30s or 40s, they're going to be on the bench for four decades. And yeah. This is massive change for most of our lives.
Yeah, Kavanaugh is going to be there for a while if he is confirmed, which it's looking very likely he is.
Do you think that there's enough attention on this particular issue, that it's not just the Supreme Court we're talking about? We're talking about judicial nominations across the country.
Certainly, it's important to pay attention to. I think it's just like presidential elections suck up all the air in the room. It's easy to look at the top bench and say that is the story, but really it's these lower courts that are vetting all these cases, and that's where it matters most in the end. And unfortunately, a lot of these appointees don't get the attention they deserve.
Before we go to break, just quickly, Rebecca, I want to also ask you about Andrew Wheeler, because he is not out in the media as much as Scott Pruitt was. Are there many investigations against Andrew Wheeler like there were against Scott Pruitt?
Not quite. There's been a few interesting cases of how he deals with former clients. He was a former coal lobbyist, if you remember, and he's played a much lower profile. I like to think of it, he has the same policies as Pruitt. He's, in fact, actually repeated some of the exact same talking points as Pruitt, but he does it with a slightly different tone. He's actually been more open with media. He had a nice welcome at his last Senate hearing. So policies have continued. He has maybe been a little bit smarter about how he's operated under the radar.
Well, after the break, I'd like to ask you what is actually happening at the EPA, you know, the significant changes under Scott Pruitt, and then what Andrew Wheeler is doing and what we can expect from him. Today, we're joined by Rebecca Lieber. She writes about environmental and climate policy for Mother Jones. In 2017, she was given a SEAL Award as one of the 10 best environmental journalists in the United States. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on Local Public Radio, KALW, a show that relies on engaged listeners. You can join today's conversation by calling 866-798-TALK, 866-798-8255, and you can post a comment or a question on the website at yourcallradio.org, or tweet us at Your Call Radio. Coming up at 11, a further roundup of the week's news on 1A. Stay with us.
This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. If you are a new listener on our Media Roundtable every week, we invite journalists to talk about coverage of the week's news and undercovered stories. We're talking now about the environment, and in about 10 minutes, we will get an update on the nationwide prison strike. We're joined by Rebecca Lieber. She writes about environmental and climate policy for Mother Jones, and she was given a SEAL Award as one of the 10 best environmental journalists in the United States last year. Let's hear from a listener. Let's go to David in San Francisco. Hi, David. Welcome to the show.
Oh, morning. I'm glad you're talking about this. And in fact, as you're talking about pollution issues, I'm really surprised that when the right wing were yammering about Obamacare, they weren't going after the high costs of health care caused by pollution. So if the cancer clusters are rapidly rising and regulation on pollution is being yanked, there's got to be a correlation. And so polluters are the ones that are causing these health care costs. And rather than cutting out hospitals and cutting health care coverage, they should just simply be billing it to the costs of production.
Well, there's a lot of reporting out about air pollution. National Geographic has a long piece called Air Pollution Robs Us of Our Smarts and Our Lungs. A study published in the Proceedings for the National Academy of Sciences found that long-term exposure to particulate matter, sulfur dioxide and nitrogen dioxide, leads to cognitive declines in study participants as they age. And, I mean, Rebecca, in the West, we cannot escape just the pollution in general, but then the fires add so much to it.
Yeah, the caller makes a great point on Democrats not always connecting the health or really anyone connecting the health and the health care and how pollution interacts with all of these issues. I think environment, climate change is sometimes considered as this faraway niche issue, but really it's so intertwined with our most important policies on healthcare. And I'd like to see people make that connection more often.
Well, thank you for the call, David. Before the break, we were talking about the EPA under Scott Pruitt. I mean, he did a lot in a very short amount of time. When you wrap up everything he changed, what would you say is most significant, and the rollbacks to environmental protection specifically?
Yeah, the rollbacks, he's lost quite a bit in courts on the regulations. So that might not be where he's made his biggest impact. Mm-hmm. I think when I talk to EPA staffers, former EPA staffers, they constantly point to two areas that he's had the biggest damage, and they're not on regulations necessarily. It's the institution and the science. He has driven out so many staffers just through attrition, through buyouts, through other means, through making their jobs miserable. And so he's driving out expertise at the EPA while making it a harder place to recruit young, smart people to take seriously this mission of public health and pollution. And at the same time, he's also Pruitt and now Wheeler have attacked the science that is really the founding for everything the EPA does. It's required by Congress to base its policy on the best available science. But what do you do when the EPA under Trump has said disregard the best available science? They've issued several rules and changed advisory boards to move the EPA away from considering that science and instead look more to partisan interest, partisan research in supporting these rollbacks.
So let's talk about Andrew Wheeler. The NRDC has a whole fact sheet about Andrew Wheeler. His biggest clients when he was an energy lobbyist included Murray Energy Corporation, which bills itself as the largest coal mining company in the U.S., The CEO, Robert Murray, fought the Obama administration's attempts to reduce carbon emissions and strengthen environmental and public health laws. Wheeler also serves as vice president of the Washington Coal Club, a powerful yet little-known federation of more than 300 coal producers, lawmakers, and business leaders. So that's Andrew Wheeler's past just in the last couple of years. So far, what has he been doing at the EPA?
Well, he has, like I said before, he's had a lower profile, but he has shown all signs of continuing these deregulatory policies. He, one thing I'm waiting for, I think will be interesting to watch, is the public comment period just ended for this proposed regulation to drastically change how the EPA considers science. And limit the studies that it uses. And what Wheeler does with this next, because now the EPA has to consider the comments and propose next steps, will be a big part of his legacy if he continues with this. Another thing that he did recently was roll out the replacement for Obama's landmark climate regulations on power plants. And Wheeler's replacement, which began under Pruitt, is incredibly weak. It reduces carbon from the power sector by 1.5% compared to what Obama's did was about 30% by 2030. We're talking about minuscule reductions in carbon.
Mm. Vox has a long story about this, the six things you need to know about Trump's new climate plan, and we'll put a link to that on our website. So we want to end with you, Rebecca, by talking about what's happening on the streets. You are here in San Francisco for the Global Climate Action Summit. There's a number of things happening through the weekend and next week. Various world leaders, people from business. It's one of these conferences with big names. Then there's also going to be a number of demonstrations and things happening on the streets. We're expecting rallies around the world, really, tomorrow, but there's a massive rally that is taking place in San Francisco. First of all, what's going to be happening behind closed doors?
Well, there's going to be a lot of pledges. I wouldn't say so much closed doors, because I think it's going to be a lot of showmanship and rallying, saying this is how many people who are still committed on climate change despite Trump. So there's going to be a lot of announcements from business and states and cities around the world showing that commitment. But also some interesting things to note is China has a strong presence at the summit and has a delegation here on electric vehicles. And it's interesting to see how countries have, instead of engaging with the U.S. federal government on climate because it's not engaging, they are engaging more at the subnational level. You mentioned the rally. One interesting thing there is there's actually going to be protests of Jerry Brown, who has a very strong climate platform and certainly has done a lot on this issue. But there's also a lot of protests that he has helped along natural gas. He's extended the life of fracking, and he hasn't done enough to tackle transportation emissions in California.
Mm-hmm. And so what actions are planned to specifically focus on what's happening in California and Governor Jerry Brown?
I think, this rally, I think there's going to be a strong contingent from environmental activists focused on that, but also California just has such a strong presence at this summit since it's hosting it. There's going to be announcements from mayors. I expect some new announcements from Jerry Brown and California of how they're stepping up.
We should also note some news came out from the UN. Patricia Espinoza, head of the executive secretary of the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, gave a talk on Sunday in Bangkok last week and said that governments around the world are not on track to meet a goal of the 2015 Paris Agreement of capping temperatures well below 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit.
We are so if you consider all these actions from the subnational level and countries' pledges, we are still only halfway towards that goal that Paris set out. And even that is too much warming. So the world agreed to keep warming to well below 2 degrees of above pre-industrial averages. But Paris only gets us to 3.3 degrees about. That is doesn't sound like a huge difference. It is huge. We are talking the difference between millions of people losing their homes to sea level rise and maybe something, or hopefully something, that is an environment we can adapt to. That's why the summit is so important, to to push momentum forward on this issue, because what we have is not enough. Even if we stretch ourselves, that will still not be enough. We have to talk about a huge transformation of the entire global economy.
Right. And the activists on the streets tomorrow are calling for 100% renewable energy. And they have been working for months in the lead up to all of this. There's a number of contingents. Indigenous groups will be in the front, and then a number of contingents will also be at the rally.
Yeah, I think the activist energy on this is phenomenal. Covering marches in the past, that's where all this starts. The ambition doesn't come from the politicians;
right.
It comes from the activists.
Rebecca Lieber writes about environmental and climate policy for Mother Jones, and she was given a SEAL Award as one of the 10 best environmental journalists in the United States. Rebecca, thank you so much for your work, and thank you for coming in.
Thanks for having me on.
Thank you. And now we are going to talk about the nationwide prison strike. On April 15th, 7 prisoners were killed and 22 were injured after violence broke out at the Lee Correctional Institution, a maximum security prison in South Carolina. Those who died were killed by fellow prisoners who made homemade weapons. A witness told the Associated Press that bodies were stacked on top of each other. The witness also reported that hours after the violence started, correctional officers and medical personnel failed to treat the wounded. In response to that deadly riot, men and women incarcerated in prisons across the country launched a national strike on August 21st. It is scheduled to run through September 9th. The press release from the Jailhouse Lawyer Speak says, quote, 7 comrades lost their lives during a senseless uprising that could have been avoided had the prison not been so overcrowded from the greed wrought by mass incarceration and a lack of respect for human life that is embedded in our nation's penal ideology. These men and women are demanding humane living conditions, access to rehabilitation, sentencing reform, and the end of modern-day slavery, end quote. Joining us to talk about media coverage of prisons and the prison strike is Raven Rakia. She covers the criminal justice system and environmental issues. She's written for many publications, including The Intercept, Vice, and The Nation. Hi, Raven. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, before we dive in, Raven, I just wanted to give this all some context and talk about some facts around the prison system. Just a couple, and I'd love for you to add some. The United States has 5% of the world's population, but accounts for 25% of the world's prisoners. About 2.3 million citizens are behind bars in federal and state prisons. What else do you think is needed before we dive in here, just to give this some context?
Yeah, for sure. I think another fact that's important to look at is that in prisons across the country, thousands of are in solitary confinement where they spend 23 hours in a cell a day, and that is classified as torture by the UN torture group. And I think the fact you gave was important as well. I mean, the United States incarcerates more people than anyone else in the world.
Right. And a couple others. Mm-hmm. It's just so important. Every year, 626,000 people walk out of prison gates. People go to jail about 10 million times a year. 500,000 are behind bars because of drug offenses. I mean, that is just a huge number, 500,000 because of a drug offense.
Yeah, we incarcerate people every day for nonviolent offenses, drug offenses, minor offenses, and economic offenses, poverty crimes. And it really affects not only their life, but their entire community's life, their family's life. It creates a community where people are just taken out every day, which really affects the community.
The other part of this is money. Raven, mm-hmm. I think it's so important to talk about this. And the Equal Justice Institute last year put out a report, and it found, according to the Prison Policy Initiative, that mass incarceration costs $182 billion a year, $182 billion every single year.
Right, yeah. And a lot of the services in prison also cost a lot for prison families, members. Like medical care could be $10 to $100. Phone calls to home cost a ton of money per minute. So there's a lot of money involved in terms of people paying into the prison system as well as taxpayers paying for the prison system.
Right. And prison stocks have gone up since the election. The private prisons are just bringing in so many more profits. I mean, under Democrats and Republicans, it doesn't really matter. But under Trump, they just really spiked.
Yeah, I think the private prison stock, that really speaks to immigrant detention centers in this country, many of which are run by private prisons.
What do you think of media coverage of this specific issue, just all of the money that is being made off of the prison industrial complex? Do you think that the profit and the money side gets enough attention? I mean, it does in the independent media, but what about the national media?
I mean, I think when it comes to the media covering the criminal justice system in general, there's a lot more needs to happen. But it has improved in recent years, and I think part of that is because of things like the Black Lives Matter movement. It has turned a focus to the criminal justice system in this country. But yeah, in terms of the money, it would be great to see more of the mainstream media that really has the resources to dig deep and do investigative reporting on the numbers involved and the money involved in the criminal justice system. It would be great to have more reporting on that.
You mentioned solitary confinement, Raven, and you wrote a piece for The Appeal called There's an All-Out Manhunt, A Strike Organizer Speaks from Prison. Tell us a little bit about Eddie, the prisoner that you interviewed.
Yeah, so the prisoner that I interviewed is actually a member of the Jailhouse Lawyer Speak Group, which is the group that called for the national strike in April to begin on the 21st. So he's part of basically one of the main organizing groups behind this strike. Eddie basically said that in his state, the Department of Correction are really looking for Jailhouse Lawyer Speak members throughout the prison to sort of retaliate, and the Department of Corrections would say to discipline if they acknowledged it, I would think.
You write that, like many prison housing units in South Carolina, Eddie has been on lockdown since the riots in April. I mentioned those riots when I introduced you. That's on April 15th, 7 prisoners were killed, 22 were injured after violence broke out at the Lee Correctional Institution. We did a show about this, and in so many prisons across the country, I mean, it's just, people are just waiting to explode because they don't have access to basics. The food is not made for human consumption. They're in crowded conditions, and, you know, anybody would explode, really, under these conditions. And you write that Eddie said prisoners in most units at his prison have been locked in their cells for 24 hours a day, only coming out to shower twice a week with no outside recreation or sunlight. He said, quote, "We have steel plates over the windows, so there's definitely been no sunlight coming into the room since April," end quote. How were you able to connect with Eddie?
So I was talking with Eddie through a cell phone. Eddie was on a cell phone, which is considered contraband in prisons across the country, but also in his state of South Carolina. And so that's how I was able to connect with Eddie, through organizers who have relationships with Eddie that set up basically a press conference call. So it was me and other journalists, as well as a couple of the organizers who set up the call, and Eddie, of course.
And what did Eddie tell you about the strikes, the demands of the strike?
Yeah, so the demands were created by Jailhouse Lawyers, and the group basically spoke with prisoners across the country to create these demands. So they really speak to conditions nationally in prisons, even though they vary state by state. These are national demands, and they range from everything from the conditions of prisons and prison policies to, rescinding the Prison Litigation Reform Act, and ending prison slavery, and asking for the minimum wage of each state to be paid for prisoners.
Today,
and there are 10 demands in total.
Right. Today we're joined by Raven Rakia. She covers the criminal justice system. We're talking about media coverage of the prison strike. Raven, it's hard to get confirmed numbers, but based on your reporting and what you've read, how big is this strike?
That's a great question. And, I mean, I think it's important to emphasize we really don't have the numbers yet, and we will be getting them as the weeks come because communications in prisons take very long. But right now, IWOC, which is called the Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee, which is one of the strike, has reported that there's strike activity in about 14 states, as well as Canada. So it's actually international, I guess. And then in terms of what different state Department of Corrections have acknowledged, there have been about three states that have acknowledged a strike, and the rest have mainly denied them, as far as I know.
And what do we know about retaliation? You got a comment from Eddie about how people have been in lockdown 24 hours a day. What are you hearing from other advocates across the country?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so in terms of whenever there's a work stoppage, a lot of prisons will go on lockdown immediately. So that's a way that's part of the retaliation, one can say, because, you're kept in solitary confinement. But there are other ways that prisoners can be retaliated against as well. A lot of prisoners will get conduct reports written up and then will be put in different types of solitary units, which are sometimes called segregation units, where they're also kept in the cell for the majority of the day, if not 24 hours a day. Wow. So this happens in prisons across the country. Right now, we know in Ohio there's been at least one person sent to solitary confinement. In North Carolina, there were people moved to different, more high security prisons. In California, one prison reported that their phone lines had been cut off. So there are different ways to retaliate, and we've heard of different things happening so far, but we're still hearing more.
And since we're talking about solitary confinement, I was trying to find some information about Brett Kavanaugh and where he stands on issues like solitary confinement and just prisons in general. According to Vox, they have a long piece about Kavanaugh. At any given moment, about 80,000 to 100,000 people are held in solitary confinement in the United States. And it's been that way at least since the 80s without any federal court intervention to halt it. But this could really end up at the Supreme Court. Solitary confinement could end up at the Supreme Court in the coming years. And according to this Vox piece, Anthony Kennedy, most likely based on his last decisions, would have curtailed solitary confinement. It would be a 4-5. But if Kavanaugh is confirmed, it'll flip. And according to a number of reports, he might vote the other way. Have you read anything about Kavanaugh and specifically solitary and where he stands on prisons?
Yeah, I personally have not. But yeah, there is a concern that Kavanaugh will flip a lot of the decisions that were starting to go towards the way of criminal justice reform. Mm. So yeah, that's a general concern that I've heard.
I wanted to also ask you about media coverage, Raven, because when the prison strike started on August 21st, we were wondering, are the national media going to cover this? And it did get coverage. It took a while, actually, but the New York Times, NPR, covered it. There was a piece in The Atlantic published last week called "The Viral Success of a Strike No One Can See," and it made the case that this prison strike gained traction by using, independent media and social media rather than trying to get attention of the larger outlets. And then big media followed, not wanting to miss out on the buzz. What strikes you about how and when national outlets started covering the strike?
Yeah, I mean, I think that was a great piece. I read it as well in The Atlantic. And I also think that prison organizers have come to depend on independent media just because that's the only people that would report on it. So I think it may have been out of necessity as well. But prison organizing has been happening for a while. There's been another national prison strike 2 years ago in 2016, and there's definitely been a lot of prison organizing within the same state. Like Alabama there's been a number of work stoppages organized that the department recognizes, and many prisoners have been retaliated against because of it. And in Georgia, there was a work strike in 2010 as well. So I think for the past eight, probably longer years, there's been a movement forming in terms of like a are like, you know, contemporary prison movement, and with like same goals and same ideology behind it, with, you know, human rights goals and that sort of thing. So I think now mainstream media is just now covering it, you know, in 2018. They've caught on kind of late, but now there's been so many strikes that they've heard about, they were able to know in advance that this one was happening. And so, you know, it finally happened that mainstream media started covering it. But I think independent media has been covering it for a while.
Mm-hmm. There was a cell phone video of an inmate in California's Folsom State Prison. He recorded himself turning down food as part of the hunger strike. And as you said, while cell phones are not allowed inside the prisons, they're common. And you wrote about this in an article for The Nation. You write that videos, photos, and other media are going to continue to leak out, probably with increasing frequency. So this shows the public what actually goes on behind bars. What effect do you think this will have?
I mean, I think cell phones have had a huge effect. And I think basically for some prisons to say, oh yes, this is happening. Like, in terms of the Department of Corrections, they tend to acknowledge it when they have to. And so, for example, prisoners being able to show what's going on in their dorm or show that they are actually striking means that the department will be more likely to acknowledge it and it will get more coverage in the media. And even if it doesn't, it gives them a way to contact the media and say, this is happening, this is what we're doing. So I think it's had a huge effect, and it's going to continue to as well.
And Raven, we have about 30 seconds left. The strike is scheduled to end this Sunday. What is next for this movement?
That's a great question, but I'm not sure if I can answer completely, of course, because I'm just covering it. But I do know that prisoners are definitely going to continue to organize and communicate with each other, and they're going to find a way to do that no matter what. And I do think we also need to continue to pay attention after it ends, because that's when the retaliation will hit. That's when we'll hear that more people have gone to solitary. We'll see conduct reports saying that this person is in solitary because they tried to do a work stoppage and that sort of thing. Or at least that's what we see in the past. So that's what we need to focus on in order when it comes to journalists and reporting. We need to make sure that we're still covering this after it ends.
Yeah, that is a great point. And we will continue to follow this. Raven Rakia covers the criminal justice system for a number of outlets, including The Nation, The Intercept, and Vice. Raven, thank you for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
If you're looking for a documentary to watch over the weekend, 13th is really amazing. It's about the history of prisons and slave labor and how we got to this point. 2.3 million people behind bars, mass incarceration costing $182 billion every year. This is a very profitable business. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, you can visit yourcallradio.org. Thanks to Andrew Steltzer for producing today and Laura Flynn for line producing. Thank you for joining our media roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.